All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fucksters? How's it going? What's happening? Are you okay? Everything all right? How's the new year going for you? Have you got the COVID? Did you get over the COVID? Did you get through the COVID? Do you think you have the COVID? Do you have any fucking tests? Where can I get a test? What do I got to do to get some tests? Is your store closed? Is your business closed? Are you not allowed to do something? Man, it's been crazy. It's crazy out here. I got a few tests. I try to stay on top of it. But I mean, I'm doing comedy shows at the Comedy Store. For why? Because I like to do comedy. I'm trying to work out new stuff. It's what I do. I drive 25 minutes to do a 15-minute set for a few hundred people in a room, some masked, some not, eating and drinking, what have you. If I do my job, I'm probably in a mild COVID mist. Got to figure at least 3, 4, 5, 7 people have it in there. Just kind of sludging along, feeling doughy, too much sugar. Trying to self-medicate with what I have available to me. I quit the meditating. My buddy Dan, we were hiking. He heard that I was cranky. He asked if I quit meditating. I'm like, I did. I just stopped. Because maybe I don't notice the benefits, but I was doing it every day. I was really locked in for a few months. And I don't know what the hell I expect to be a new person, but maybe I got to get back into it. I don't know. I'm drinking about, to be honest with you, I'm now once again making a full Stanley thermos of coffee, 34 ounces of coffee, which I drink within the first couple hours of the day to the point where I'm nauseous. And at night, I seem to be going out. I seem to be compulsively eating the large wintergreen lifesavers. They're so satisfying. And chocolate. And whatever the fuck else is around. Just like a garbage mouth. It's like any cookies. What difference does it make, right? Live it up. Live it up. I got to reel it back in. I think it's just been stressful the last 2.5 fucking years. But no, I've been stressed because I told you about the cats. I told you about Buster being sick, not eating for 5 or 6 days. And the other morning I woke up and he was there on the bed, on the, you know, sitting, I'm putting my socks on. And he's just sitting there in front of me. And I'm just like, you know, come on, dude. I'm tearing up. Are you going to get better? What's going on? I can't take this shit, man. And then I don't know, out of nowhere, he just, you know, he started eating. He can't stop fucking eating now. And he's eating a food that he never used to eat. He's just eating constantly, this cat. And he's acting like himself. And I'm so relieved to see the guy get back, like, just be himself. This is a fucking cat, man. And I just can't believe how disrupted and how sad and how it really shook my life up. I got to reel that shit in. But it's my life. It's my life. I think it was a cleaning product. Because either that or Sammy just started throwing up out of, you know, in a sympathetic, like, he saw Buster get sick, so he threw up too. I don't know what you call that. Sympathetic or, I don't know what you call it. I know there's a phrase for it. Maybe it's called codependency, a relationship. When your buddy or your partner gets sick, you get sick. But it's not contagious sick. It's just you feel their feels. I think it's a cleaning product. I think I gotta, you know, I gotta start having the floors cleaned with some sort of edible product, something plant-based. I don't fucking know. All I know is I know they're back. Buster is back. Because the other morning I woke up and the cabinet where I keep the snacks and the food is at my eye level. You know, you gotta open this long cabinet and it's about 2 shelves up, big shelves, where the snacks are. And sometimes if it's cracked, if the cabinet is open a little bit, if Buster works at it, he can get it open, but he's still got to figure out how to get on a shelf. It's not easy. And I woke up the other morning and there was like the high-end snacks, freeze-dried chicken, freeze-dried other things that they enjoy, just the bags ripped open all over the floor, just all over the floor, like they couldn't eat anymore. The only thing that was missing was the two of them just laying there all fat, unable to move from the massive fucking snack party they had. It's just waking up to that. You want to get angry, but I'm like, all right, this is who we are now. You just rip this shit up. Don't give a fuck. That's cats. But I was happy. It showed incentive. So on the show today, Javier Bardem is here. He's an actor. Most of you know him from No Country for Old Men, Skyfall, Before Night Falls, Dune. He was also a very big star in Spain before he ever even started working in America. He's married to Penelope Cruz. You know him? You know him. His new movie is Being the Ricardos, where he plays Desi Arnaz and Nicole Kidman plays Lucille Ball. It's written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. And I had him over, but there's a bit of a story to it. You know, I'm asked to have people on the show, right? That's how it works. Get pitched people who are out doing things. He's out promoting the Being the Ricardos movie. But anyways, most people know the show, or at least get hip to it, you know, before they come over. So anyways, you know, Javier is supposed to come over at a certain time. The car shows up. I walk out to the gate. He already seems aggravated. I mean, he gets out of the car and he's like, I didn't get the results of my PCR. And I'm like, okay, I'm waiting for the results. And I'm like, all right. I said, I tested negative this morning, antigen test. And I said, when was your last antigen test? He said, yesterday, negative. And I'm like, okay, so let's go. We can do it, right? He's wearing the mask and it's just like, it's tense. And then we walk into my house. It's just me in the house. And I shut the door behind me, and he's walking into the house. He's like, where are we doing this? Where are we doing it? We're going out back into the garage, you know? And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, what is happening? Why is this, you know? I've done, like, what, almost 1,300 of these things. I've dealt with all sorts of tones, introductions, you know, ways of being upon arrival. But I just couldn't understand what was up. He looked tired. I didn't know when he flew. He came in from, you know, Spain. So I open all the windows and we sit down and I turn it on and he's like, what is this show? And I'm like, okay. He doesn't know the show at all. And you'll hear that. Ultimately, it was a great talk. We had a great conversation. And to be honest with you, I've sort of got to give myself a little credit. You know, because he's out on a junket. He doesn't know the show. And we got to sit here for an hour, and he didn't seem to know anything about it. He's like, do you just like actors? And I don't take it as an insult, but it does in that moment make my job difficult. So how am I going to ease into this so we can have, you know, a comfortable conversation for an hour? Free form. Like, I know stuff about the guy. I do a little bit of homework. But how am I going to, you know, trick him into easing up, into relaxing, into engaging? And I do it because I know instinctively in my mind now, you know, how to sort of manage this. But there is a thinking to it. There is it's sort of a testament to the nature of interview or the nature of podcasting, the nature of personalities that sort of come through in this medium. I can't explain it, but there's definitely a skill set in place at this point. And it's definitely a hyper-engaged skill set. It's not a skill set that enables me to sleep through anything or to get through anything or to make it necessarily easier to get through it. I need to engage. So I got to figure out a way around this guy's not knowing of the show, mild aggravation, the fact that he's probably used to giving these short interviews all the time and kind of relax into something organic. And I was pretty proud of myself, to be honest with you, because it was one of those moments where I realized, like, who the fuck does this? Who just talks for an hour? Who talks for an hour? Because for me, it's fun. This is my social life, and this is engaging with somebody else who has an interesting life. I enjoy it, but it's not something that happens in life much. And I just start to think about that, like, why would anybody want to sit and talk for an hour? This is the gig. This is my life. How do I get this guy into my life? And I think we did all right. I really do. All right. So, you know what led up to this conversation with Javier? And I like the guy. We had a nice, I think after all was said and done, he had a nice time. He reported back that he did. So, this is me talking to Javier Bardem. The movie that's out right now, Being the Ricardos, is streaming on Prime Video, and it's pretty good. If the actors get the hang of that Sorkinese, it can be pretty good. Okay, here we go.
I'm not familiar with the show.
Oh, with the show? Well, let's see.
Because
so,
I live in Spain.
So. I understand. And you can't get the internet in Spain. I understand.
It's on internet? Yeah.
Yeah, you can get it right. It's a twice a week podcast. I've had many of your contemporaries on. Last week, I had Clooney on. I had Ridley Scott on last week or 2 weeks ago. I had Guillermo del Toro last week. Was great. So I interview people in the business. Started as a show primarily interviewing comedians, which I am, and kind of evolved into this thing. I had Obama on the show when he was president. So it's that.
All of them came here.
Obama came to my old house. He sat in that chair, but it was at the old house, a smaller, shittier house that he came to. It was kind of a big deal when the president comes to a small, shitty house.
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah, it was good. So that's sort of what this is. It's a show that's on twice a week.
And how come are you so interested in movies?
I don't know.
It's all in movies or also music? Or
sure, I do music. I've interviewed Keith Richards, Roger Waters, rock guys. It's basically... I started the podcast before it really got popular, podcasts.
Okay.
And it just branched out. I'll interview anybody who's creative or in one of the creative businesses.
Right.
Directors are a little tricky to get because they're busy. Right. Musicians are odd because they don't have to talk.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Right. Some of them like to talk. Are you a Pink Floyd fan?
Yeah.
Like I had Roger on not too long ago, and that he's definitely got things to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
The funny thing is about guys who are guys who've been around that long. Right. He kind of says I don't want to talk about David Gilmour. Yeah, I want to talk. That going in, but within 5 minutes he's fucking talking about it.
Right.
But that's sort of it. That's what happened. And I was. And I act, and I do stand-up, and I do this.
Okay.
I was in Spain, actually, the first time. I won an award in Spain.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, in Gijón, is that how you say it?
Gijón.
Gijón, yeah. The film festival there in 2019.
Yeah.
I was there with my girlfriend, Lynn Shelton, who's no longer with us, who had directed a film, and I won Best Actor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that was the first time I'd really been to Spain in a way where I could hang out.
Okay.
It was great. Do you know that film festival?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, you must have been there a lot, right?
A lot. And also, it is followed by a book.
Which one?
Literature festival.
Oh, they do?
They come together one after the other.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It seems like a nice town.
Yeah, I love it there. And the people there is very friendly.
Yeah. What part of Spain is that?
North, that's Asturias.
Yeah.
What
separates them? What makes... Because I was in Madrid for one day when we came back. And the only plan we had was to go to the Prado Museum to visit a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good museum for that. Where if you get in your head, like, I'm going to visit this.
Yes.
You can go visit it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not as big as the Louvre.
Yeah.
So you don't get crazy going around it.
You don't get exhausted.
But it's amazing. Are we recording already?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Now, the thing about the, but that museum, though, they do a thing that I never seen before. They these are the things you might want to see. They'll lay it out because they know.
Of course, you have Goya, you have Velázquez, you have, and also you have also
Bosch,
the Bosch, which is crazy. And and
Velázquez, right? Yeah, Titian, all those. You do the one of the Goya of Saturn eating his kid. That's the best one.
It's very dark, and it's very good.
That whole room, man.
And I had the chance to go and visit after the COVID.
Yeah.
And they put all the, what would be the most famous, not famous, but celebrated paintings.
Yeah.
All together.
Yeah.
In 3-4 spaces.
Oh, really?
And that was something really extraordinary to watch.
So somebody curated it? They just took the three of, like, how many, like, from the entire museum?
Well, the whole Goyas, the Velázquez,
yeah.
The Walsh, as you said, and there were many others. there is one painting.
Yeah.
Of I don't recall the name now. Jesus.
Yeah.
Italian painter.
It happens.
It happens, especially when you are in front of a mic, right?
It happens to me when I wake up. I don't.
Okay, Raphael. Jesus.
Raphael. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Good. You got it.
It's a portrait that it's not too big, but it's extraordinary to watch at, to look at, and that was there, and that experience of being alone.
Yeah.
Because there was not many people.
Yeah.
In front of those paintings are. It was extraordinary. It was absolutely amazing. I would say it was the first place I went to visit after, once I came out of the house.
After the first wave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it really kind of is amazing how paintings over your life change with you, you know? That you can like have a different experience with them every time.
Yeah, I guess they're alive.
Right? Yeah.
The good, everything that it's created with genius,
yeah,
it's always life. No,
that's right. I think that's a good way to put it, because like I always say in a similar way, that when you approach something, if something is genius and you keep going back to it at different points in your life, it'll grow with you, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I feel that all the time with literature and with paintings.
Yeah. Paintings, books, yeah. Music.
Yeah.
I mean, how come a song written in the 30s can be so life today, because it lasts, because it really was made from a different place, not a logical place, not a place that belonged to an era, but a place that belongs to us as nature, and that applies for any creative form, I think.
Yeah, that I mean, that music's magic. I don't understand, you know, like how music works, but you know, it's like it stays with you forever. You just hear that song and you're like, oh shit, there it is.
Yeah. For me, it's the same.
Yeah.
For me, the music is the most complex and profound and complete art form.
Yeah,
for sure.
All of it. Like, all music. Like, what do you listen to?
Well, I'm 52 years old, so I've been very much into the rock and roll.
Sure. I'm 57.
Yeah, of the 80s and the 90s.
Oh, that, yeah?
That's the time where I shape my musical instinct.
Your brain?
And likes.
What are the building blocks?
Well, I will go very much into Led Zeppelin,
yeah,
and the Purple.
Yeah.
And, of course, AC/DC.
AC/DC, the first six. The first six.
Yeah.
The Bond records.
Yeah, of course.
Those are the ones. And Back in Black. After that, okay.
Yeah, I know. But still, you see them live and it's crazy.
The
Have
best,
you seen
right?
them live?
I haven't.
You haven't?
I haven't. You know what? I did. When I was in high school, I saw them open. I swear to God, they opened for Journey. I swear to God.
Oh, wow.
In 1970, it must have been six. I was in sophomore, and I was there to see Journey. That's the fucked up thing. That's a sad thing. I don't like admitting that. But I did see Bon Scott's AC/DC.
Wow. What year was that?
Well, it must have been the first tour, like 76, 77, 77,
yeah.
Right?
It's High Voltage.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the time, yeah.
The best. I listened to them still every, like, weekly.
Yeah.
I listened to them yesterday when I was hiking.
All right.
I listened to the live one, the Bad Boy Boogie on the
if
live.
If You Want Blood, You've Got It.
Yes.
The album, that's the best, one of the best live albums ever.
Oh, man. When they come back in on Bad Boy Boogie after
and the opening of that album, Riff Raff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That is rock and roll.
It's the best. Do you have that live at the Atlantic Studios? Do you know that live one that they did?
Yes. Of course.
Oh, my God.
Of course.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. And I had the chance to meet them personally in 2015 in a concert that they did in Spain,
and I
put myself on my knees just to embrace the little guy,
to
Mr.
Angus?
Young. Yes.
So yeah,
and he was scared because I'm so big compared to him. Like, what is this? Who is this Spaniard? That is because he meant a lot to me since all my childhood And I started to listen to them when I was 9 years old.
Nine?
Yeah.
Nobody plays guitar like that guy.
No. Nobody plays guitar like that guy with that amount of energy, one after the other.
Those licks, man.
He's relentless.
Those licks. I mean, it's like, it's not complicated shit, man.
No.
It's just it.
Yeah.
So did he talk to you? Did you talk to him?
Yeah, I talked to him. And I talked to Brian Johnson, who was there as well.
Yeah.
And they were very happy because I brought like some friends of mine, and we brought him a good hum and a couple of bottles of wine. And they kind of seem very happy with that.
Spanish ham.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, it's hanging in all the windows there.
Well, I don't know about the windows. Yeah, well, some of them. Yeah, the bone is hanging there.
Yeah. Some have hair
in
on
the kitchen. It. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you get the knife and you visit that.
Well, I think often. In the butcher shops, you know, I just saw the hams. And yeah, I guess that the hairy ones are the boars, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's the best quality of them is it comes from Salamanca, from Jabugo. Jabugo, it's called. It's very easy to find great ham in Spain. That's for sure.
That's the thing?
Just, ham? It's not a brainer.
Ham is the thing.
Spain is the thing.
So you want ham? Go to Spain.
Exactly. I mean, is that obvious?
Yeah.
Is that realistic?
So you start listening to AC/DC when you're 9. Like, who turns you on to that?
My brother.
You got the older brother?
Yeah, he's 6 years older than me.
Yeah, yeah.
He was 16.
That'll do it.
Of course.
The older brother.
I was chasing him. I was following his steps. Yeah. And of course, but then he kind of gave up on that, and I follow it. I became more of a big
You went
follower.
Deeper?
Yeah, I went deeper. I bought all the records. And
deeper into the hard rock?
Exactly.
Into the metal?
Into the metal, yeah.
Where do you draw the line at metal, though? Like, I mean, like, how metal do you get? What are we talking? Like Judas Priest? Like,
oh, yeah.
Megadeth?
Yeah, I can do Megadeth.
Oh, yeah?
Metallica? Of course, I love Metallica. Metallica is like a symphony of metal.
Yeah.
I don't know. I will draw the line with a Slipknot.
Okay. Yeah.
That's not my...
I tend to, like, I like hard rock more than metal. Like, I don't consider AC/DC metal.
No.
You know what I mean? No,
That's... That's heavy. Rock.
Yeah, and I came into Black Sabbath later, you know, not as a kid. And I can appreciate Sabbath. Yeah. I can appreciate Megadeth. But, I mean, AC/DC I listened to.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened? Your brother just got out of the music thing? He just went a different direction?
He went pop.
Do you remember the day? Was it a fight?
No, he went more pop, and I follow him as well. And I have to say that because the musical taste that he had,
yeah.
We start to learn together, we welcome every kind of shape or form of music. We love it.
Do you have musicians in the family?
My uncle,
yeah.
One of my cousins,
yeah.
Juan, is a musician. He's a professional musician that makes scores,
yeah.
For movies. He's great. He's an amazing musician.
Oh, has he done some big work?
Yeah, in Spain. For
oh, yeah?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
That's the interesting thing about it. Like, so much of your early career was in Spain. And it's weird because, like, I was trying to remember, I was talking to my producer where I first saw you, and I can't even... I saw you in a movie playing basketball in a wheelchair. It was like an Almodovar movie. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's called Life Flesh. That's 96.
So was that like one of the first ones or no?
No, my first one really was around the 89, 88.
Right.
But the one that kind of made the thing broader.
Yeah.
It was 91 called Jamón Jamón.
Right.
Ham.
Yeah, ham ham.
And that one that you were saying, Life Flesh, came like 5 years later.
And but that was the only time you worked with that guy, huh?
I worked with him before in a movie called High Heels, just saying a couple of lines.
Yeah.
Like a little extra with two lines.
So you were kind of in and around the show business all the time from when you were a kid.
Yeah, yeah, because my mom was an actress.
Big actress?
Yeah.
TV, movies?
Especially theater.
Oh, theater.
And then also, I mean, she would do whatever to earn her money.
In Spain?
Yeah. In Spain. And my grandparents were actors.
Really?
Yeah. And the family of my mother, they were coming from a long destiny of actors and actresses. My uncle was a director. So
film?
Film director called Juan Antonio Bardem, which he was one of the rock bases of the Spanish film history.
Really?
Yeah. He won Cannes Film Festival, and he was imprisoned by Franco regime.
Did you know him?
Yeah, I knew him. I knew him a little bit, of course, because my uncle was like, I think he was 12 or 14 years older than my mother.
Yeah.
So there was a gap of age that will make the relation a little bit difficult.
Sure.
So we didn't hang out too much with them, but yeah, we had a relationship, of course, and he was a great man, and I know my cousins, and I love them. All of them work in the film industry.
So you brought up around movies, and you could go see the movies, and you'd be like, that's my uncle's movie.
The first time I went to see a movie of his, that it was very political, about one politician in Russia.
Yeah.
It was a story. It was kind of a documentary in the communist era.
Yeah.
I fall asleep into his shoulder, and he didn't wake me up.
Yeah.
He kind of understood. It was a little bit too heavy for me to watch at
the time.
How
old were you?
I think I was like 11 or 12.
How are you going to understand that?
Yeah, of course. But yes, I'm very proud of him. And funny enough, he was the first Spanish director ever to be nominated for an Oscar in the year 58.
Really?
Yeah, which is something that I realized in the year I won the Oscar, which was 2008, because it was 50 years later. Huh. Exactly 50 years. And my mom told me, like, wow.
For best foreign film?
Yeah.
No kidding. I wonder, and he didn't win it.
No. My Uncle Jack, that was the French movie that won.
I can't imagine what it feels like to be part of this sort of like a legacy of cinema people and actors. I mean, what'd your dad do?
My dad was a businessman. He was trying to make a living out of this or that.
And, oh, yeah? Hustler?
Yeah, I mean, he was a man who was not very much into the arts at all.
Yeah.
And he didn't really approve much that we became actors, because he knew the upsides and downs, the ups and downs of this.
Your brother's an actor, too?
My brother's an actor and a writer.
Yeah.
My sister is an actress.
Oh, my God.
She has been running two restaurants lately, and she's been on the business, which is a very hard business.
In Madrid?
Yeah.
So you go to a restaurant?
Yeah, I used to. Now the restaurants are closed, and she's back into what I know, and I feel it was her real passion, which is acting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel like, now, did all of you guys, did you all train, or did you just sort of come into it? I mean,
I don't know. I start to work little by little, and then...
Was it always what you wanted to do?
No, no. I wanted to be a painter, and I study bel arts, and I...
What kind of painting?
It was more into drawing. Drawing?
Yeah, sure.
It was always very like realistic painting.
Oh, really?
Like faces, bodies, like that, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
The expression of the face would be the thing that I was more interested in.
You don't like abstract?
I do like. I mean, I'm a very good friend of Julian Schnabel.
Right, because of the movie. Yeah.
He's a great painter. I don't know if that's abstract or not.
It's certainly abstract, yeah.
What I mean is when something is done and it's beautifully done and there's a real artist behind, you feel something about what you're watching, whether it's abstract or realistically.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And so I'm fine with that. But it's true that I am more drawn into kind of the drawings.
Yeah.
Rather than the paintings.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I like watching, I don't know, like Goya.
Yeah.
He was a great, I mean, he's an amazing, he was a genius and everything.
Yeah.
But you can see the traces of the drawing into the painting.
Yeah, yeah.
And how he put the paint on top of that.
Right.
And in a very loose way.
Yeah.
And at the same time being so precise in what has to be shown and what has to be darkened.
Yeah.
And that all is in the hand of a genius. But
do you still paint?
I don't. that's sad. I should go back to it. But I guess I kind of let it go, and then little by little, I understood that those things, unless you practiced, it goes away.
It's hard, I think, too, when you have a dream to do something well, and you, for whatever reason, get away from it, that, you know, going back to it's kind of difficult. It's kind of difficult to go back to it as a hobby without being haunted by it somehow.
Absolutely, and not be too hard on yourself.
Right.
Like trying to really make something good out of it rather than just express yourself or have fun with it.
Exactly.
No.
I got all these guitars. I never, ever tried to be in a band.
Right. But you play guitar.
Yeah, I love it. But if I was trying to be in a band when I was younger, it would be different.
Right.
It would have a different meaning. I play with people, but I never believed that I was going to be a musician.
Right.
So I still enjoy it. These aren't like haunted vessels of failure here.
But do you play in concerts? Do you get on stage with people?
I have been lately for the first time. I mean, a couple of times when I was younger, but I never played with a band. But now I play with some guys and we do covers and like, I'm like, fuck it. You know, it's like bucket list shit. You know, I've always wanted to do this and now I'm not afraid. So,
right.
And I got nothing to lose.
Right.
And I don't want anything.
And how fun is that?
It's great.
It's great.
I don't know. You know, it's great. Do you ever play? Do you play anything?
No, I like drums. Yeah. I play drums.
Yeah.
I never been in a band. But
yeah.
I'm sure that the little times where I play with my friends.
Yeah.
Not in front of anybody, just for us.
Right.
It's a different experience. It's something that's communal. It's about belonging to something.
Yeah. It's so. I mean, you must feel it too in acting as well. Mm-hmm. Because I noticed that when you watch that Beatles thing, you know? The Get Back, the documentary. I don't know if you've watched any of it.
No,
but
I haven't.
You should. Well, you don't have to. Whatever you want to do. But the point is that you know those songs are so simple.
Yeah.
But the magic is them together.
Right.
That something happens.
Right.
And it's the same with any collaborative art. That like you know you bring whatever you're going to bring to it. Either you're going to be insecure, you're going to be confident, or you're going to be it doesn't matter. But as soon as other people are involved, it's bigger than you, and something magic can happen.
Yeah, especially that. Yeah, absolutely. And also the magical of belonging to something bigger than you, as you said, and being part of something that it's not about yourself, but about something else.
Right.
That is a message that you want to get across to someone, in case that means anything to someone.
Isn't that interesting?
And yeah, that is what it should be, any art expression at all, because most of the time it's about ourselves. It's a little bit too much about ourselves trying to make a point about ourselves rather than trying to really explain or trespass ourselves to tell a story.
Do you think about that though when you look at a script? I mean I can talk about that, you know, intellectually and I think when you work with other people collaboratively, you feel that. You know, I mean, but I still think I'm kind of selfish, but when you look at like a script, do you feel like, you know, how can I get lost in this?
Yeah, you want to get lost in that at the same time to have some control over it. For me, it's basic. I guess as for a musician to be lost is, I don't know.
Sure.
I don't have any idea, but I guess it would be more about how much you can rehearse in order to get lost.
Yeah, right.
And for me, it's about the same. It's like, how really can I have a hold on into this and have something to say about it as an actor in order for me to really try to do what I think I can do best, which is get lost in it.
Yeah.
But it's not something that you can jump in. You just jump in and you say, okay, let's try this, let's try that. No, that doesn't work for me. Some other actors can do that and I really envy them. But for me, I have to have everything covered in order to jump, to make that jump and try to get lost in it.
Do you remember, like, can you identify the first time you felt that?
Yeah, I feel it was a movie called The Ages of Lulu, 1989.
Yeah.
And it was a tough role because I was playing a bisexual prostitute.
Yeah. You took it, though. You took the role, though.
It was, and funny enough, it was based on an amazing book of a great writer called Almudena Grandes,
who
passed away recently. Sadly.
Yeah.
And the movie will end up on a whorehouse where these sadomasochist practices were taking place, run by my mother at the time. I mean, my mother, another time, my mother, who was the boss of the whorehouse. So my first role was this bisexual prostitute.
And your mom was in the movie?
Yeah.
Your real mother.
In front of my mom, where she was asking me to not be too violent with one of the clients.
so
of course I have to get lost in it because it was way too hard to deal with. And now I think about it and I go, well, I was 20 years old and I was so much into it. I wanted to really give it all because it was a great opportunity. And I went not far in terms of making harm to myself or to any other, but to really imagine that man, and I follow people like that over the streets. I didn't get myself into any kind of trouble, but it was the first time that I immersed myself into some kind of atmosphere to understand what I was talking about, and I love that.
Wow. Yeah. And you and your mom was there the whole time.
My mom was there, and she said it was one of the most difficult roles she ever played after 50 years of working as an actress, because she was in one way playing the harsh, tough woman ruling, running the whorehouse.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it was my mom trying to understand or help me to do it better or to be comfortable within that situation.
Right.
So it was a tough one for her.
And
God bless her. She passed away last July.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. And I miss her so much. She was 82 years old. And she, the good thing is that I have a brother and a sister, and we were with her, and she felt loved.
Yeah.
She felt
loved. That's nice.
She felt loved. She felt a company.
And she was awake in,
yes,
you know.
Yes. Oh. Yes. She felt loved. And she felt the gratitude.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
To be there for that.
Yeah. That's the thing that keeps me, I don't know, like relieved. Like, yeah. She felt the love.
Right. You were all there.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And yeah, and like the whole family probably, right? Your kids too?
No, just us, because he was in time where people were out of Spain.
Oh,
and thank God the three of us were in the same city at the same time.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's sweet. So do you think that she was your primary teacher as an actor?
Yeah, she was a primary teacher on everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my parents split when I was 4 years old. Oh,
that's young.
Yeah. So I was raised by her, mostly. My father was there present, but not as present as he should have, maybe.
Right. Did you get resentment against your father?
No. I mean, of course, now being older as I am and being a father myself, and more of a man than a child, I can understand certain things, and I understand that people try to do their best, and sometimes you hurt someone without wanting to do so. He could have done better. He could have done more.
Yeah.
Sure. But also, he did what he could, and I forgive him for that.
That's interesting. Because I always wrestle with that. Because, like, I think, you know, people say that, like, we did the best you could. But there's a part of you that's like, did you, though?
Yeah. No, of course, we can always do better and more and better. I don't know if it's the word more or, better, or to be more aware of what's going to happen.
The consequences.
Consequences, thank you. Of our own acts.
Yeah.
Of course, we have to be aware of that. And now, as a father, I'm way more aware of that. But at the same time, we have to also frame them in the moment they were educated as children.
Yeah.
My father was educated in a moment where manhood, it was a very, very thick and solid, and
they had to be at a certain type of strength that was,
yes,
was there a macho element?
Yeah, you can call that as well. And the women in Spain and today, but thank God today has changed so dramatically.
Yeah,
still more changes to come, we wish.
Yeah,
but women in the time were, I mean, my mother couldn't have a bank account by herself or couldn't travel alone. I mean, so those things, of course, shape the way you see the world as well.
Yeah.
And that was, he was educated into that. That being said, he could have been more present. And when you say to a kid, I'll be there, and you don't show up, that's bad.
That's bad. That's the bad part. You know,
that's bad part.
No matter what the intentions were.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, because you hear that story all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be there this weekend to take you to the game or whatever.
Yeah.
They don't come.
Yeah.
It's always the saddest fucking story.
Yeah.
But it's not unusual.
It's not unusual. And that's the thing that you can do better, for sure.
Wait, could you even imagine, though, like, I don't know who these people are. I mean, I don't even have kids, but could you imagine telling your kid, like, I'll pick you up at 5, and then, like, 2 days later go, like, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot.
No.
How the fuck does that happen?
No. Absolutely. And I can think of that. I can imagine that.
Yeah.
I'm not that guy. I mean, I flew sometimes, mostly whole the world around just to be with them for a couple of days. For me, when I'm working outside, out of my home, I'm always saying that I have 2 weeks in my genetics. I can stay away from 2 weeks. More than 2 weeks, I can.
And then you got to carve out the time to go back?
Yes, I have to go back.
Because sometimes you shoot forever. I mean, sometimes you're shooting for months.
Yeah, absolutely. But I have to if they kind of travel with me, then I have to go back. And whatever
yeah.
I am. I
don't yeah. I'm the same way with my cats.
Mm-hmm. Of course. My sister is having a problem with her cat now, and she's devastated. I know how important it is.
I was having one. I'm just getting through one now.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know what the hell is wrong with them. I mean, it's a weird thing. It makes you feel silly. But if your life, like I don't have kids, if you have these things, these animals, and they're part of your life and they're part of your pattern, and you put some of yourself, they ground you, you know, you love these dumb things.
Absolutely.
And if one of them is like fucked up, you're like, your whole life, everything gets thrown off.
Is your companion?
Yeah, kind of. They don't do much, but you know, they're there. They're consistent.
How long have you been with them?
These ones?
Yeah.
I got a new guy, he's less than a year old, and then the other guy's like 5 or 6 years old, and then there was two that were old and they're dead now. But yeah, I mean, kids is different, obviously, you know, they're never going to talk.
You mean the kids?
No, my cats.
That would be scary. Hope not.
Very, very exciting, though. And then I know what the fuck was wrong with it for the last 2 days.
That's true.
But were you brought up with, you were talking about that the Catholic guilt in Spain, like that's heavy Catholic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been, no, it's better. Now the new generations, I think they are dealing with it way better than what I had to deal with when I was younger.
Yeah, I guess in historically, Spain has been as violently Catholic as you can be, really.
Well, Inquisition yeah, was <exactly. laughs> made up in kind of in Spain, right?
Yeah,
We have Torquemada, and we've burned some witches, and we've burned some witches and some books as well.
Yeah,
and we've chased those who were not doctrinated by the Holy Church, and we've made them feel guilty and punished them
rid of the Jews.
Get rid of the Jews and the Moroccans as well.
Yeah.
It's a country that has been very powerful in many ways by shaping itself with lots of invasion or conquering as well.
Meaning,
there's no big empire in the world that has not done so.
Sure.
I mean, and we always have to be historically accurate in order to make a thing about it.
Yeah.
And understand that when these people were living in the 14th century, they had some issues to deal with that we don't have today.
Yeah, thank God.
But yes, the Catholic Church.
It's funny you say we don't have those today, but like, you know, when you talk about, you know, Franco, we're kind of coming back around to that, sadly.
Well,
globally.
Exactly. Yeah. The stream right wing, what you call it, whatever we call fascists.
Yes, fascists. Let's call them what they are.
Yeah, is raising up in Europe big way.
Yeah.
In Spain, we have some of them actually having a room in the Congress.
I know, yeah.
And it's,
scary.
It's scary, and also, but we have to pay attention to that because they are not there for free. I mean, there is people behind them.
Yeah.
That are voting for them.
Right.
And there are some other democratic political parties that are supporting them in order to get their support so they can get more things moving forward, like the right wing in Spain is really being supported now by the extreme right wing, and they are going hand by hand in many things that are kind of scary and going backward to what it was in the 60s or in the 50s sometimes. For example, with the rights of the lesbian, gay, transvestian community, bisexual community. I mean, they are, as we speak now, dealing with things that have been approved and have been moved forward successfully.
Yeah.
Now they are trying to get it back and
push it back.
Push it back. And it's... That's one of the examples. The environment will be another one.
Not that different than the Inquisition, in a way.
Not that different than the Inquisition, I don't know, but not that different by of the time where Franco was living, and you would be scared if you were homosexual or if you had some political views that were not... that were against the regime. Of course, we have democracy and we can speak loud. But the problem with this is that when you are whitening, when you are washing,
yeah,
that speech on TV on the Congress, some people out there feel the power, feel empowered to do the actions. And it's very alarm to see how much the violence has increased towards gay people, lesbian people, lesbian community.
All around the world.
All around the world and in Spain.
Yeah.
Because that's where I'm more familiar with.
Yeah.
I mean, like, brutal.
Yeah.
Because they know these people, they think they are represented.
Sure.
And you got this guy here called Trump that kind of did the same.
Yeah, they embolden people to be intolerant.
Absolutely, because they feel represented by people that are really one way to go.
Yeah, well, that's what they want, that one way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what was your uncle putting? Was he in trouble?
Yeah, he was in prison because he had to do with the Communist Party in Spain.
Yeah.
And he was in prison, and he was chased, and he was persecuted, and as he was my mom as well.
Yeah.
My uncle was, it was worse for him because he was politically outspoken and very well, he was obvious. He was also
public personality.
Public personality. Yeah. And also through his movies, you can tell he was doing a very thorough critic against the regime.
But that's something exciting to have grown up knowing. That must have been something you, at some point in your life, grew to respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in my house, we haven't had much when we were growing up.
Yeah.
But one thing that I've seen firsthand is that wherever we had, we share it.
Yeah.
And we really didn't give our back to the people that are most needed around us.
Yeah.
Whether or not we had more or less, that's not the point. The point is,
help.
Show us what you get and share it.
Yeah.
And be around and surround yourself with people that are going to create a community.
Yeah.
A unity with you.
Sure.
Towards what is the right thing to do, which is not, of course, my right thing to do is not the same as the extreme right-wing right thing to do. But there is one thought that my brother the other day shared on a TV or in a radio program, which is like, it's like some of the extreme right wing people say, you think you are morally higher than me, and that's not true. And I say, well, it is true. In the moment you are chasing or trying to get, for example, the collective rights from lesbian, gay people and kind of not condemning the violence against them on the streets, I am morally higher than you.
Yeah.
So, yes, and that's a wrong thing to do.
Right.
So, of course, there are right things to do.
Sure,
And that's, I guess, where I learned with my mom and my family. Like, okay, also we were living in an area where, as I said before, my mother was having lots of trouble by just being a woman, being an actress, and being a single mother.
Yeah.
That alone will create a lot of danger for her on the streets.
Yeah.
So I saw that as well. So that by itself empowers the women, in my view.
Right.
Like
knowing the strength.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
the admiration I have toward women in general.
Sure.
The strength of a woman, a mother, trying to cope with so many elements and at the same time being able to feed us all.
Yeah.
To feed the three kids.
Well, now, what were you, when you were growing up, were you like a fighter kid?
Yeah, I was. I was. I was because the man in the house was not there to say stop it.
Right.
And my mom was, her hands were full of things. And also she was trying to do theater and TV and she has to tour around Spain.
Doing theater.
Exactly, for months.
Right.
Back in the day.
So you're just at home kicking ass?
Exactly. And we didn't have much money to hire someone to take care of us.
Yeah.
We did, but then my sister took care of us.
Yeah.
But she was very young. She was a kid herself.
Right.
So that's the ambience where you grow up. And of course, you are watching your older brother as the example, as the man in the house.
Uh-huh.
But he was 12 or 13. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so, of course, you follow him and then you get in trouble.
Yeah. So you're a troublemaker. Yeah.
I used to be, also because in the day, maybe it's different today or not. We live in a neighborhood. We live in a place where you go on the street and you you shape your and form yourself on the streets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I think it's a little bit more different.
It's all online now.
Exactly. No, it's through Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. So really, so you had to go out there and get scrappy just to show the neighborhood what was up?
Yeah, but I would always call my brother. He was bigger and older. But yeah, I'll be behind.
But the Catholic thing, that didn't get into your brain?
No, my grandmother, my father's mother, she was very Catholic, and she will take me to the church many Sundays.
yeah.
And I will be there, and it will be a place where I will feel kind of safe.
Sure.
I was little, and I felt like to be in a church, actually, it's a beautiful thing.
The pageantry of it.
Absolutely.
All the wizards.
Absolutely. It's like it's a sacred place. So sure. you feel that weight.
Yeah, you
especially
do.
Especially when you're a kid. But I didn't follow it up. No.
So you, but you, you don't have anything? You're not a spiritual guy or nothing?
Not really.
That's good.
Not really.
It's okay.
Which I wish I had. I mean, really? I believe, for example, when I do, let's say I play this Yarnes in Binda Ricardo.
Yeah.
He's a real person.
Yeah.
Well, I talk to him
mystical plane.
Yes, and I communicate with him or what I think it could be him.
Well, the good thing about Ricky Ricardo is that there's plenty to see.
Absolutely.
I watched that movie the other night and I thought it was a great story. Mm-hmm. And I certainly didn't know much of that. Mm-hmm. And and I thought you guys handled the Sorkin ease very well, because that's the trick of that guy. I mean, it really all hinges on the actor's ability to perform his writing.
Right.
And I thought you guys did a great job with that.
I mean, it's demanding when you're working with Aaron Sorkin's words. It's demanding because they are so rich and powerful. And
there's a rhythm to it.
There's a rhythm into it,
It's almost like the 30s. There's a thing that happens with him when it's done well.
But it's funny because you will think of Aaron as a director asking you to speak faster.
Yeah.
And it's the opposite. He wants you to breathe and to be in silence and taking what you've been said.
Uh-huh.
And be aware and be, that what you're saying has to create an effect on the other.
You know why? I bet is because, he loads up those sentences. Like, if you don't do it right, it's not going to sound natural.
Absolutely.
So in order to make Sorkinese sound natural, you've really got to, I guess, think it.
Yes, think it and also making it organic.
Right.
He's a great actor's friend because he knows how to put the lines with such a continuity that when you jump into the lines, you don't need to add or take out anything.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you need to say, no more, no less. That's in the hands of many few of them. It's not easy to find.
He's precise.
That. Yeah, he's precise, but also he knows what the actor needs to say.
Yes.
And that's great. But at the same time, you have to be very, very truthful with what you're saying. Otherwise, it's going to sound like a script.
Right. That's exactly. It's hard, because I've seen his stuff done well and I've seen it done badly.
Right.
But you guys did a good job of it. And now, so when you took this role, I mean, you knew Ricky. Mm-hmm. We all know Ricky.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that made you go, okay?
I don't know. First of all, working with Aaron. Second, I was very drawn into the story.
Yeah.
Him being a foreigner, a Cuban, the States, the 50s in the United States, the communism. But most of all, the love story between them. I think for what I read, for what I saw, from what I heard from Lucy, their kid, their child.
You talked to her?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and she's been very helpful, and she's a great lady.
Uh-huh. Is Desi Jr. still alive?
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
You talked to Lucille Ball's, the daughter?
Yeah, daughter. Okay. Yeah. And he was madly in love with Lucille Ball.
Yeah.
And he will do everything in order to protect her. And take care of her. Mm. And there was also something going parallel to that, which is Speaking of which, we talked about before.
Yeah.
His education as a man in Cuba.
Yeah.
That will bring some issues with it.
Sure.
But he won't feel that as an issue itself. He will feel like that's the way I am.
And right.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's interesting. Her decision, you know, when it happens finally, not to deal with it, you know, the timing of it. And it's also like it's a pretty, you know, feminist movie, really, you know, in terms of how he and how I think she really was. But in relation to the give and take of what happened, you know, him being protective and ultimately doing what he did on that set that day. Mm-hmm. But her also saying like, no, I don't know if I can live like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And also, it was the last drop. In the glass.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it is feminist in the sense, I don't know if the word is feminist, but I think it's very obvious that it's empowering a woman, that it was very powerful. And
yeah,
she
I think
empowered
that's
herself.
Right.
And in the moment where being a woman and a foreigner, it was kind of a weak point to be somewhere and make something out of it. And they both had one of the most amazing and prolific studios companies, I mean production companies ever.
Desilu,
run by a woman and a foreigner. So that speaks volumes about who they were.
Yeah, so like working with Sorkin, though, the precision of it, I mean, like going back, I mean, what are the different, like, because it seems like somebody like Schnabel is going to be a little more fluid.
Mm-hmm.
Like there must be a completely different game.
Yes, it's different. Julian will paint
scenes
with you, and Aaron will be more like precise, and he wants the things to be contained and framed into what it is, no more or less than that.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, with Schnabelin before Night Falls, that was the first Oscar nomination, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how much of that, like, how much of that was your role in that was in terms of character was collaborative, or how much did you sort of like pull together yourself?
It was very collaborative. I mean, Julian is a great guy that I adore, and he was so helpful, and he is so helpful and so loving. We worked together, and we tried different things. And it's funny because I always thought that movie was kind of an experiment for me.
Yeah.
Like a try for me to see if I was capable of performing in a foreign language.
Oh, okay,
never thought that movie was going to be, I mean, received or seen by so many people.
For
so,
you, it was just sort of like, I'm going to try it. This is a nice low-key project.
Exactly. That's what I thought. And then out of a sudden, the movie turns out to be a great movie that still really resonates.
Yeah.
And I got a nomination for an Oscar, which is like crazy.
So you did it.
Yeah, I did it. And I guess if I knew that before shooting, I would have done it worse.
You would have been self-conscious.
Exactly.
So that was really the first full English movie you did?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It was the first... I did one before that in Spain called Perdita Durango in Spanish, where I was playing Mexican, but it was not an American. It was an American production. So,
like now you work with what's his name, Iñárritu?
Yeah,
yeah,
Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Yeah. I talked to Del Toro about that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the three of them, the Mexican directors, the Trinity of Mexican directors.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, like in terms of culturally. I mean, it's very different, right? I mean, it's still a Latin world, but I mean, Mexico and Spain is different.
It's like being, I don't know, British and American or Australian. I think it's more or less the same.
Right.
We share some things in common. If I watch a movie in Mexican, I can... And if they go into the slam or like on the way they speak on the streets, I won't get a word out of it.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And the same for them. We do in Spanish, in Castilian Spanish.
Right.
But we share some impulse and I don't know. We share the blood as well. I mean, I was doing this.
Thanks to the Inquisition.
Exactly, and the conquerors.
Yeah.
I was doing this great project about Cortés and the conquest of Mexico that unfortunately was canceled after the COVID because many things.
A movie?
It was a 4-episode series.
Oh, miniseries, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a great project. And that, I was very much into telling that story because for Spain and for Mexico, it's a big thing, especially for Mexico, right?
Yeah.
But again, we have to revisit that world with the eyes of the time.
Huh.
Today, it will be very brutal.
Yeah,
what we did, and it was brutal. But at the same time,
it's Cortez.
Yeah, it's Cortez. It's the time that it was.
Yeah,
and also they were encountering the unknown and the Aztecs, which were not also kind of soft.
Right.
So I'm not justifying or excusing anything. I'm saying that the clash of these two wild worlds together made
the conquerors and the indigenous people.
Exactly. Made what happened being a possible outcome.
Right.
The possible outcome.
So, it's too bad that they're not going to make it.
Yeah, it's sad. But that being said, I have, I work with Iñárritu, and I think he's one of the greatest directors. I mean, it's fantastic, of course.
It's funny. It was funny when talking to Del Toro about him, because Del Toro will have those, he'll have him come over and look at his edits.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Iñárritu will say, like, I think this scene's a little long. And I'm like, that guy? He's going to tell you what's long?
It's funny because the three of them are great in what they do, Alfonso, Guillermo, and Alejandro.
Yeah.
But they're different.
Oh, totally.
It's great. No?
Yeah.
They have their own thing.
Yeah. It's incredible. So in terms of precision, it seems that, like, there's, the Schnabel movie puts you on the map here,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the Coen brothers got you, that movie got you an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
But but those guys are precise too, right?
The Coens, yeah, they were precise. They were so precise that they will give you a storyboard script.
Oh, really?
Where everything was already drawn. And,
right.
But they will be very open to also change it if they need it. But they knew the movie way before they said action.
Yeah.
They knew the whole movie.
Right.
And Roger Deakins, the amazing DP, was there, and he did a spectacular job. And yes, that was precise, but also it was precise, but that precision was on my side because my character is very precise as well.
Yeah.
He's not somebody loose.
He's controlled.
He's not, exactly. He's in total control of what he does best.
Even his haircut.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's no one hair coming out of the place.
Yeah. And who made those decisions for the character? You? I mean, I know it was on the page.
The Coens decided the haircut based on a book with photographs of a brothel in the borderline with Mexico in the 50s.
Interesting.
Yeah. There was a guy there with that haircut, and they say, we want this. And they say, okay.
You know, it's one of the most amazing scenes in that movie that, like, only because, speaking of painting and the way that they you visually see something, and I'm curious as to how many times he shot it, is that when he strangled that guy on the floor and the boots were marking the floor, like that shot after he dies with those boot markings is like an abstract painting.
Absolutely.
How many times you get to do that?
The strangulation happened it was complicated because I have to have the guy who was playing the sheriff, the guard, the police guy, the officer, he had an harness.
Yeah.
And my handcuffs were attached to that harness.
Right.
So I could pull without strangling him.
Right.
But it was so painful for both of us.
Yeah.
But still, in order to make it look realistic, we have to spend basically the whole day doing that scene. So those marks.
Yeah.
Were after many takes.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So did they have to wash and get new marks many times?
Or, no.
The marks were one take.
Yeah, yeah.
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 That was an amazing visual thing, and it's something I always remember because it almost, the marks almost sort of transcend the event.
Yeah. The violence, it tells you how violent the situation was.
Yeah. Yeah, but also on their own.
The desperation.
I just remember it.
It's a great shot.
Yeah,
the desperation, the agony.
Yeah.
of the prey.
Sure,
right, being hunted.
Yeah, and how do you like working with Brolin?
I love Josh. I know him.
You've worked with him before too, right? Were you on? Did you do Dune together? No.
Yeah, but we haven't worked. Actually, we haven't worked in scenes together.
Wow.
We only one phone conversation.
Yeah.
In No Country for Old Men, and in Dune we haven't worked together. But I would love to work with him in Dune too.
Yeah. Well, he's like, you know, I think both of you guys have, you know, it's like there's certain people that just, you know, that hold the screen without doing anything. And you guys are those kind of guys, you know. I talked to him.
Oh, yeah.
And I never met him before. And, you know, he drove up like you did. And he got out of that car and I'm like, oh, shit, this guy is a real deal.
He's great. He's great.
Right?
And he's one of the funniest person ever.
Very funny.
Did you laugh that day?
Yeah. I'm oh, sure yeah,
you laughed
yeah.
your ass off.
Well, there's certain guys that are like, you know, that, like there's a certain quality. Like he's a movie star, mm-hmm. you know. And there are certain movie stars that, you know, are just well-rounded, you know, funny guys. And yeah. and then you start to, you kind of talk to them, and you're like, I understand why you're a movie star. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right. But also, beyond being a movie star, he's a great actor.
Great actor.
And very, very intelligent dude.
Yeah.
A great guy.
So is Clooney. Great, great actor and, and funny guy. And so are you. I mean, but do you see yourself as a movie star?
No.
No,
I guess the idea of a movie star is more about... something that excels the fact that he plays a role,
right?
Something
oh,
that is
oh, right, interesting.
It's something that is overwhelmed by many other elements that makes him or her something unique.
That's interesting.
And not only a good actor or good actresses or well known, is like wow. I don't know if you tell me.
It's something transcendent. Like, it, no absolutely. Matter what role they're playing, even if they're doing the role well, you're like, that's fucking Clooney. Whatever.
Yeah.
It's interesting. That's a true thing.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know if that's a liability in your life. I mean, they all seem okay. I mean, I've talked to a lot of them, but there's something probably good about just, you know, being focusing on the acting as opposed to worrying about being a movie star.
Yeah, especially when you are not supposed to be a movie star, you have never planned to be a movie star, and you are never gonna be one. So yeah. You just do your job decently and try to do it as decent as you can.
Yeah.
And listen, I'm an actor, and I'm blessed by the fact that I can work,
right?
Get a job,
right?
Be paid by it for it.
Yeah.
Most of the actors and actresses are unemployed. It's a huge percentage of unemployment in the acting world. And to be able to look back and at the time that we were speaking about the Ages of Lulu with my mom, and said, well, I've kind of worked constantly since the 90s.
Yeah.
With some ups and downs, but mostly like in consecutive years.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
To celebrate.
Yeah, you got a lot of, you know, and you got a good resume going. And how often have you worked with your wife?
I worked with her, Jamón, then...
So that's where you met
Woody
her?
Woody Allen. Yeah, Woody Allen's.
But when did you start dating? After Woody Allen?
Yeah, in 2007.
So you've been together since then?
Yeah.
So those are the only two movies?
No, and then we did two more.
Oh, yeah.
Loving Pablo, where I was playing Pablo Escobar and she was playing the journalist.
Oh, yeah.
That fell in love with Pablo. Yeah. And then one with Asghar Fajardi called Everybody Knows.
And do you like acting with your wife?
Yeah, she's a great actress.
Yeah, she is.
We know each other well. There's a lot of work that is already done.
Oh, yeah, right.
We don't need to excuse ourselves.
And she works with Alma.
Or ask for permission.
Right.
We just go for it.
Sure.
But at the same time, if it's too intense, it can be like, okay, go back to house and be dad and mom.
Right.
After
right. Sure.
An intense scene is kind of not the most ideal. So we both think, okay, let's do it, but not too often. Like right. here and
oh.
there.
Oh, interesting. So like what actually comes home with you that makes it tricky?
Well, like when we were doing Loving Pablo, I was playing this monster and she was playing this victim. And there were scenes that were very brutal, not physically brutal, but emotionally and psychological.
Yeah.
And try to go back to be just nice and okay and relax and just make some dinner.
Yeah.
It was difficult because there's always something holding inside of you when you've gone that way, when you've made that journey.
Huh.
It's normal. You've put your body and your emotions and your voice and yourself into it. So you're not going to wash it up wash it out just because you clap your hands or because you snap your fingers. It takes time.
Right. So do you think that there's a moment, too, where she may think, like, I didn't know you had that inside of you?
Of course. Of course. Of course. Of course. Of course you go, did that scare you? And she was like, well, I wasn't expecting that, and which is a good thing, because you want to surprise your partner.
But then you
want
to put it away.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, great talking to you, man. Thanks for
coming
by.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you.
Thank you very much.
Javier Bardem. Yeah, we did all right, right? Being the Ricardos is now streaming on Prime Video. Go to WTFpod.com/tour. For all the upcoming tour dates. I've heard nothing about any of them getting switched or fucked with. Okay? Now I'm going to I'm going to play guitar. Monkey, La Fonda, Cat Angels, everywhere. Everywhere.